Warning, this is not your father's history. This is not the history your coach taught you in high school. And you won't find it on the History Channel either. No, you see, this is the history your mother warned you about. This is History Against the Grain with your hosts, Chris Padgett and Josh Weiner.
Episode 64, Liberating Narratives. Welcome to the podcast where we, in the words of Walter Benjamin, regard it as our task to brush history against the grain. I am one of your hosts, Josh Weiner. With me as always, Chris Padgett. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Josh. Feels good to be back on, you know.
I know.
We've had a lot of summer now to reflect upon. And I know you especially, you've been a traveling man. I have to say, I was impressed with the arc of your recent trip.
Yeah,
we saw you in the perfectly sublime landscape of Glacier National Park 1 week, and the sweltering desert of Las Vegas the next. How did that go for you?
It was a fun trip. We tend to do a road trip at least once in the summer. And this year we went to, drove to Glacier National Park in Montana, spent 5 days total, you know, getting there, then hanging out there. And then me and my middle son on the way back flew from Spokane, Washington to Las Vegas. And I don't know if there's two more different places than Glacier National Park in Las Vegas. So that adjustment, I swear the first 24 hours there, I felt like I was going to have a seizure or something like that. The lights and the sounds and the people and the heat compared to the quietude. Glacier National Park has people there. It does get crowded, but just the quiet and the beauty and all that kind of stuff contrasted with the glit and the glamour and the filth of Las Vegas was, it was stark. But good trip overall.
Well, I'm glad you made it back home safe and sound from Las Vegas, for sure, because you were well within the thermal dome, as I heard it referred to, that had gripped much of the country, including parts of Northern California, because we've had it pretty well this summer.
I just read that climate change seems to be affecting everybody except like the central coast of California, which is just as cool as ever. So if you're looking to move, you want a safe place, and you can afford the central coast of California, that might be the one haven left as everything gets sweltering and dangerous out there.
Weather of a different kind, let's say a stormier weather, never disappoints us, has been in raging in the history culture wars of the country. You and I talked a bit over the course of the last few weeks about the latest sort of rage incident in the Twitter sphere, anyway, was the report put out by the Department of Education in Florida regarding the new history standards there.
Yeah, just so brutal. You don't want to get to a point where you're not shocked by this stuff, because it should be shocking, but it's certainly not surprising at this point what we're seeing. And this has been a long running thing. I think we talked about this, episodes ago, about what was happening in Florida, about the new school of Florida being basically taken over by right wing functionaries and all this kind of stuff. But when you see these standards, it truly is an example of why seeing history as this progressive arc is not particularly explanatory for our current conditions. Because, in many ways, these standards are going back to, stuff that you're reading about and writing about that was happening in the 1920s, 1930s, 1950s, 1960s in terms of the presentation of American history. So seem to be going a different direction, and it doesn't exactly seem to be progressive.
No, I think there's a deeply, sometimes we call it conservative strain. I might have other names for that. but let's call it conservative, you know, a deeply conservative, racially exclusive, Ten Commandments oriented
Yes.
interpretation of the past. And you know, and I think you're absolutely right. The thing is about it, you know, is that what I call the standard version history of the country, you know, has always taken its cues from, you know, partisan politics. In other words, early in the nation's history, when there wasn't much of a national history yet, they'd essentially manufacture it, you know. So the nation itself, you know, born, I guess you would say, of the American Revolution, you know, maybe the Constitution, what we call the United States, was essentially an invention, you know. And so to create a national narrative, they had to you know, draw from the materials at hand. And basically that meant drawing from the kind of patriotic gore of partisan politics. In other words, there wasn't a 4th of July that would come and go where, you know, some, you know, partisan political hack would stand maybe even literally on a stump somewhere, you know, in a town, you know, to deliver a 4th of July oration that, you know, paid homage to the founding fathers and kind of filial pietism, you know, of our nation's founding. And, you know, I mean, partisan politicians did that for the same reason they do it now. It plays with the base, right? And it gives them a kind of, oh, I don't know, what would you call it? You know, a kind of symbolism, you know, with which to identify their particular brand of politics. So, you know, voting for the Federalists, you know, back in the day in the 1790s, or voting for the Jeffersonian Republicans, or, you know, later the Whig Party, you know, or some of these sort of bygone, you know, political entities, you know, today it would simply be, you know, the kind of DeSantis Republicans, although it seems like maybe there aren't as many as he had hoped outside of Florida,
No, that's
given
right.
his approval ratings, or the Trump Republicans, you know, that you know, we recalled, for example, at the end of the Trump you know, presidency, how there was that kind of ham-fisted attempt to create a 1776 commission. You know, and the real interest here, you know, I think it's fair to say, is never, you know, in the history per se, it's in creating that sort of symbolic identity, you
Right.
know, so that when you vote for us, you're voting for this narrative, you know,
And
and
this view of this country and yourself,
yeah,
which always
right.
stands in contrast implicitly or explicitly to, you know, in DeSantis' case, the wokeism or the woke mind virus, whatever dumb phrase he's using, which is infecting the minds of those who are less vigilant, I guess, right, to stave off these ideas. So the idea this is a return to something pure, the idea this is a return to what real history is supposed to be, is built into it. Right. And that's regardless of the truthfulness of it. It's the symbolism, as you said, of these ideas.
Yeah, it's a kind of you know, a sort of, I guess, historical leap of faith to just simply believe, you know, and you know, there's this notion that out there exists something like what? Essential history.
Right.
You know, as you say, the pure truth of the past or something, and that it exists apart from us, whether we choose to acknowledge it or not. And so we're sort of honor bound to do that, you know, and then call it, you know, call it history. But when we think of the partisan origins of these things, there's nothing particularly pure. I mean, DeSantis has appointed all those members of the Standards Commission. They're political appointees, you know, and realizing the spoils of office and that sort of thing, you know, their job is to create these standards that are, that what? That align with the political ambitions of, in this case, the governor, you know, of the man who's running the man who would be president. And that they're going to reflect that, because like everything else, there's a just gigantic vacuum effect in Paul. Everything gets sucked into that overriding, you know, interest. So yeah, so it always you know, it's a little disconcerting, actually. I would say it amuses me. I don't feel amused by it. You know, I think it's frustrating. You know, it's eternally frustrating for us. You know what I compared it to, Josh, is like, and we'll talk about some of the content of it in just a second here, but is being a historian in this climate, right? It must be rather like being an epidemiologist in the COVID breakout, you know, where people are making all kinds of uninformed, but obviously political driven claims about the nature of the virus and how we best protect ourselves, whether it be the anti-maskers or what have you. And to be sitting there, you know, as an epidemiologist thinking, oh, good Lord, I've wasted my life.
Yeah. All the careful study, all the stuff I've done means nothing. No, I think that's right. And, you know, we don't want to make the comparison too close, but there is danger in the historical version of that as well. The stories that they're pushing through these new standards are fundamentally dangerous because of what they suggest about our country and who it's for and who it's not for. So what about the standards stuck out to you the most in those terms?
Yeah, well, there's been a kind of, you know, slow unwind there in Florida, you know, punctuated by these moments when someone bothers to step forward and say something really dumb, you know, is what we call the white nationalist narrative. And so these particular standards refer to the teaching of African American history or Black history. Now, we've already seen, you know, DeSantis had essentially what barred, I think, the AP course on African American studies, I think it's called, right? You know, for being, in his parlance, too woke. Mm-hmm. And so these standards likewise have sort of pared back what is often perceived to be a kind of critical edge to understanding America's racial past, obviously slavery at the forefront of that racial past. And so talking about slavery, which our country has never successfully done, in my estimation, I've said before, you know, we came somewhat close with the national broadcast of Roots back in the late 70s, you know, when I was a kid, people were actually talking about slavery.
Right.
In a semi-informed kind of way, you know, because, but the bar was very low because prior to Roots, it was Gone with the Wind, you know, that mm-hmm. set the bar for most people, the popular imagination of what slavery had been. So, so Roots kind of, you know, kind of raised the level of that discourse. But as a country, no, we've never, you know, Barack Obama's election was supposed to usher that in. You know, Obama himself gave a well-known speech as a candidate in Philadelphia about the Constitution, the unfinished work, you know, in our country of racial equality, et cetera. So you can kind of pinpoint these moments. There's so relatively few of them. But what's happening now is the pendulum is swinging completely the other way. We're not having conversations, you know, about race and the problematics of race or slavery or anything like that. We're reducing it once again to a kind of fable, you know, that in the political sphere, you know, translates into that kind of identity politics, where, I mean, including the identity of white nationalism. So, for example, the attempt, because, you know, conservatives are always sort of on their heels with this kind of stuff, those who want us to have that unproblematic, filial, pietistic reverence of white founding fathers, many of whom, of course, were enslavers, have always, you know, had kind of an awkward, you know, to square that circle, you had to explain, you know, how these supposedly universal values of liberty and equality, et cetera, you know, were managed by these men who were, you know, essentially owing their positions to being slave, you know, enslavers. So it's always been a little awkward for the right, except for when the story just simply gets reduced to that kind of fable of the American dream. And that's what I see working here with the Florida standards. In other words, slavery wasn't an onerous system of racial prejudice and inhumanity, Josh. It was a kind of training school for lifting yourself up by your bootstraps and getting ahead in life, you know? And what am I talking about? I'm talking about the standards that depict slavery as a skill, as a process of skill formation for enslaved people. Let's see if I can pinpoint this, okay? In a statement, two members of Florida's African-American History Standards Work Group defended the language in question, citing 16 individuals who, they say, developed valuable skills while in bondage. Now, lest we think that this comes out of thin air entirely, there's a kind of long-standing narrative about slavery that saw it as a system of social uplift that brought from Africa, where they lived in, you know, a kind of primitive state. They were brought into the sphere of Western civilization. And even in the context of slavery, we're introduced to, you know, Christianity and the growth of a market economy, which, you know, supposedly endowed them with these skills that we're talking about. And look, I mean, it's true. I mean, enslaved people were put to labor on virtually every imaginable task, you know, in the so-called building of the nation. But turning that brute fact of exploited labor, uncompensated labor, into what, a kind of poster for individual uplift.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting ahead in this world. Would you, I mean, is that kind of how you see the argument going?
Yeah, it's extremely ugly. You know, in the teaching profession, we call it professional development, that slavery is kind of this professional development program. And, you know, we were talking about this earlier, and there's seems to be a real connection between how they're promoting this idea, right? So slaves or enslaved people earn valuable skills or learn valuable skills through the process of enslavement, and kind of how they see education as well. And I'm not just talking about conservatives now. I would say, you know, kind of liberal view of education is increasingly more skill focused and mm-hmm. marketable skill focused. Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be a real connection between, you know, the way they're presenting
yep.
enslavement as a professional development opportunity, right?
Make your job ready.
Make your job ready, right? So that enslaved people, when they were free, which for many of them, that's never, because they died in enslavement, for many others, because, you know, emancipation didn't come until the 1860s, well after the lifespan of many of them. But that they would exit when they were freed with these marketable skills that they could then, as you said, lift themselves up with their bootstraps. So it's a troubling argument that fundamentally, you know, kind of caricatures this entire history in a way that takes this horrific institution and kind of sanitizes it in a way that, you know, again, would have been very common in, you know, the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and, you know, pretty uncomfortably close to our own day as well. So, again, a step backward in so many ways.
Yeah, I know. And it really reminds us, you know, that the sort of the promise of liberal progress, you mm-hmm. know, that we reach a certain threshold and a breakthrough in human rights or, you know, natural rights or something. And that once we reach that threshold, you know, we've passed almost like a level in a video yes. game or something. Yeah. You know, you don't have to go back to it. But clearly that's not correct, you know, because, you know, the river bends back on itself all the time, and so does history. So as you point out, you know, this could be the Scopes trial or something in the 1920s, you know, what's happening, you know, here, where we want to, you know, a biblically based biology teaching or something, you know, in this case, history. And as you point out, and I think this gets us back to some of the partisan issues, you know, is this idea of job readiness. The essential purpose of education isn't in that kind of liberal arts model, you know, to expand the mind, to create critical thinkers, independent thinkers, you know, well-informed cultural literacy or something, global perspectives, that kind of thing. That really it's job ready, it's career training.
Yes.
You know, and that if you can create a narrative that suggests that slavery, after all, instead of being, you know, an unspeakable indictment against the very foundations of our nation and those who led the nation, those we call founding fathers, instead of being an unspeakable indictment, it really was a kind of visionary plan for career readiness.
Yeah,
you know, slavery was.
It's such a hard, you know, from that conservative perspective, it's such a hard thing they have to square, because on the one hand, they want to, you know, pat themselves in the back or pat Americans, white Americans in the back for, quote unquote, liberating the slaves, freeing the slaves, mm-hmm. while also mm-hmm. making the argument that slavery wasn't that bad in the first place. So you kind of see the contortions that they have to go through to craft these standards. Is they want to have it both ways, right? That this was ultimately a useful project, right? That also had to end. And that's how you end up with this. That might be giving him too much credit, because I honestly don't think DeSantis has any broader goals than other than, kind of, placing himself at the head of this anti-woke crusade and that kind of stuff. And this is all just part of that. But it's why it's hard to find an honest conservative historian, because in many ways their worldview contrasts so specifically with what good history is. And we kind of see it in standards like this.
Yeah, and the thing that interests me about that is, because I agree with you that it's interesting to watch the contortions that follow to make these narratives somehow even vaguely make sense, is the way that narratives of all stripes face a similar kind of quality assurance check. In other words, even what we would call liberal progressive notions of U.S. history, and we've had our fair share of fun taking on some of those people as well. The Sean Wilentzes and Jill Lepores and others who see it, yes, slavery as a great abomination, but one that was ultimately resolved in the context of a liberal progressive, political order, as if the U.S. system is capable ultimately absorbing all things like a shark stomach or something, just absorb all of it and keep on going to the betterment, the resolution that leads to the better, more progressive era. And as we're saying, I mean, I think that's equal bullshit because, if like passing a level in a video game keeps you ever ascending, how come we're not ascending? How come we're still fighting, as you point out, these retrograde arguments from long ago, which, by the way, lest we shrug it off and say, oh, that's just a bunch of, goofy politicians in Florida, consider what the College Board, did with its own standards for the African American studies class. Now it re which was at one point fairly edgy, fairly critical, but which now reads like this: the College Board's advanced placement class in African American studies, quote, in addition to agricultural work, enslaved people learned specialized trades and worked as painters, carpenters, tailors, musicians, and healers in the North and South. This is the AP guidelines. Once free, African Americans used these skills to provide for themselves and others. To me, what's so interesting about this is how this retrograde narrative just simply becomes embedded in what seemed to be perfectly non-controversial, perfectly mainstream, in this case, advanced placement standards that a majority of the high schools in this country adhere to, right? In other words, there's again the gravity of this thing, the vacuum effect is how what would otherwise maybe be easier to write off as just some, partisan scheme or something to appeal to the base takes on the imprimatur of respectable mainstream history. Like, if you divide, well, it's not right wing, it's not left wing, let's divide it in half and call it respectable mainstream history. Because I think the damage done there is even greater, I mean, assuming that, DeSantis's poll numbers mean anything, he's likely to become part of the same, what, swing of the pendulum, I guess, soon enough he'll be gone. I mean, listen, I'm trying to avoid the apocalyptic view of it all. But that, like, the 20s turned into the 30s, that these swings of the pendulum. But in the meantime, what is the residue that gets left behind? And I would say it's in the AP standards. And I want to just cite this one last seemingly innocuous part of that statement, right? Which said, once free, comma, African Americans use these skills to provide for themselves and others. Now, I did a quick calculation, Josh. What would you say the typical a generation is about, what, 20 years?
think so. Yeah.
in a life cycle of human beings or
Right.
something. So if we start with, let's say, 1619, just as a well-known sort of touchstone date, when you get Africans, imported to Virginia, an early colonial era. 1619 to what? The Emancipation Proclamation or something, or 13th
Sure.
Amendment, let's say
Okay.
1865, right? I figured that's something like 24 generate 22 to 24 generations
It's a lot.
before there was any thought of emancipation. Even if we lop off the last couple and say maybe you would have been, seeing emancipation coming around the corner or something once Lincoln declared it or so, whatever. We could fudge these numbers a little, but essentially 20 generations of Black people in what becomes this country in the eastern seaboard of North America, eventually what we call the United States, 20 generations. And there was no thought given over to that innocuous little phrase, once free, unless it was what? Part of the self-sovereign effort of enslaved people to achieve their freedom by force. In other words, what you might call slave rebellions or running away, but certainly nothing in the infrastructure of the colonies or the later the nation, the sovereignty, the ruling interest that was suggesting something like once free. I mean, you begin after the revolution seeing gradual emancipation schemes in some of the northern states, but even those are qualified and limited. Nothing like once free was even a part of the mental framework of this world. So for 20 generations, people were born, lived if they lived, and ultimately died as enslaved people.
Yeah.
Their children, their grandchildren, great job. I mean, count down the generations. So what actually, Josh, is the AP board talking about here, once free?
I mean, it's this thing we've been critiquing for like 64 episodes now, right? Which is this teleological history where everything is seen from this eventual outcome, but that eventual outcome means nothing to those generations and generations and generations who don't know what's going to happen, who are just living their lives and doing their best to survive in this immensely cruel system. So the only point of that once freed is to, I don't know, soothe the feelings of people who don't want to see the true horrors of this system, and only want to see it as something that exists in order to be abolished, right? Which would
Yes.
happen eventually, but again, that
It's coming.
eventuality has
Yes.
no meaning for 23 out of the 24 generations
Right.
that you mentioned.
It's a strange sort of condensing of the temporal sphere of history,
Right.
into a kind of microsecond that the phrase once freed,
Mm-hmm.
or the imminent moment of that. You know what I mean? That that's
Right.
happening all along, and it's happening. It's imminent that it's happening, when in fact it wasn't imminent. It wasn't even close to being imminent. And never mind what happens once freed materializes, the nightmare that is Jim Crow America.
Yes.
Never mind that. I'm just talking about how we telescope this thing, and look at it through the wrong end of the telescope so that 300 years becomes something imminent, a progressive narrative. And I think that's how, we did a broadcast back a ways about, I think it was the bewildering effect of
Yeah,
narratives,
right.
right? And that's how we get bewildered, in our storytelling and our learning of stories, the stories that are told to us, as students, as citizens, et cetera, is that we just become accustomed to thinking about slavery as something that is only significant because what? It ended. It is only significant in the frame of liberation and emancipation. On its own terms, it's not particularly significant, And so that's the really dangerous thing, as we talk about, more dangerous even than the kind of cynical partisan stuff, is how these narratives become embedded without any taint of falsity. They simply become like manna from heaven or something, the truth of the past. And it does enormous damage because it makes anyone who wants to argue, for anything, let's say reparations or something, or affirmative action. I mean, those are just two examples. How about policing of Black bodies? I mean, any number of things we might point to that continue to forestall true progress in this country. It somehow gives cover to those things, because to argue that there is a history to them, that the right to bear arms is itself embedded in the need for white militias to protect against slave rebellion, for example, well-regulated militias, in other words, or to point to any of these things as having deep roots back in that, well, strangely compressed temporal time that really didn't seem to last very long and was always tending toward freedom anyway. Mm-hmm. What do you do with that? I mean, what do you, if you're trying to make an argument based on any kind of historical gravity or anything, it's almost like you're written out of the game before you even start playing.
You're a bummer. Yeah. You're like the guy, you're at the party and everybody's trying to have fun and you're telling them, well, this isn't actually fun. That's actually pretty sad. And who wants to hang out with that guy? So it puts us in this position where we got to be the doomsayers. We got to be the ones who are not going to cling to this soothing narrative. And I actually do think our students are receptive to these ideas largely. I mean, you've talked a lot about how difficult it is to disabuse them of these notions that get kind of embedded in their brains from childhood. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's the thing. Like we can push back. We can push back. We can ask them these questions. But some of those old answers, some of those reflexes about how to think about history just keep coming back. And that's mm-hmm. a process that's hard to undo. We'll just, right. From our perspective, having these students for one semester, maybe two semesters. I don't mean to present us as these lone heroes fighting back. It's a larger part of the historical profession, but there is this momentum that we're trying to push against that gets harder and harder. When this is the kind of stuff students will increasingly be getting in schools, particularly in red states. But I don't want to say it's perfect in blue states either. This just makes our job harder in so many ways.
Yeah, it does. And I remember there was a American Historical Association survey a while back. They do these things every so often, sort of man on the street about history, And actually, a majority of adults, when asked in the United States, said they wanted a history that tells the truth, even if the truth is uncomfortable.
Right.
Because a lot of these sort of standards, like in Florida, are predicated on not making students feel uncomfortable because of their race.
Not making white students feel uncomfortable, to be clear.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. And yet, when you ask adults, by and large, they'll say, no, we think it's absolutely important to have truthful accounts, even if they make us. But the same people will then say, if the questioner asks, okay, should we change the stories then that we teach to the students in school? They say, oh, no. Those are the sacred stories. Those are, and I know this because I was talking to a friend of mine recently, and as you'll judge, we don't talk about history very much. Our friendship is based on other things, and I was talking about this idea of the stories we tell ourselves, that the nation is a story that we tell ourselves, and how we need better stories, et cetera. And he goes, oh, I totally agree. He goes, but some of those stories shouldn't be touched.
Ooh,
and wow. Because I want to continue enjoying our time together, I didn't actually ask him, like, which ones?
Right.
Because the ones that usually are regarded that way are the most fallacious, the most myth-ridden and moth-eaten. I just coined that. Myth-ridden and moth-eaten.
That's nice.
Josh, those hoary stories of, the founding fathers and these kinds of things. And so that's the conundrum. That's the paradox. It's like, yes, of course we want true stories, but we don't want those stories, those that are the most false, the most, fableized, the most mythology. We don't want those touched. And, it gets back to that guy, Mason Weems, who wrote the story of Washington, the life of Washington, is what he understood. He was a pastor in a church, and he understood that the purpose of these stories was didactic. They were supposed to represent some kind of lesson. The purpose really wasn't history. You were teaching some kind of morality play, and it was given historical content and names were appropriate and that kind of thing. So yeah, so when we approach the standards, it's sort of pointy-headed academic types and say, well, just a second, that's not actually true. Nobody's listening, right? At that point, really, we're talking to each other is it still called Twitter, Josh, or is it called X?
I can't talk about it.
They're just an echo chamber, because that was never the point. So if you're going to show up like Professor Actual Factual and disabuse everybody of this, then you're going to still be wondering why Donald Trump's approval ratings are so high, because that was never the point in the first place. So look, here's what I want to say for us today in this amazing episode we have, is that the purpose of our narratives, and if we have a mantra, this has got to be it, right? The purpose of our narratives, the purpose of the stories we tell should be to liberate us, not enslave us. They should be to make us healthy, not make us sick, right? And so today we have a very special guest on History Against the Grain, a man who we first met back in January at the American Historical Association, who came to mustered the resolve to come to our session and introduce himself, and a man who you've kept in touch with ever since, who has an ongoing history blog and subscription site called Liberating Narratives. And we're happy to say he's here with us today on History Against the Grain, where you had the opportunity to sit down with Bram and talk shop and about what he's doing and about his life and where his motivation's coming from. In what amounts to, I think, one of the really best interviews we've had on our program. So, yes, by all means, let's get to it.
Talk to me.
Our guest today is Bram Hubbell. As Chris said, we met Bram at the AHA conference in January. And we've been wanting to have on the podcast since then. He's very much, we'll call him a fellow traveler with the History Against the Grain boys. Bram taught world history at Friends Seminary in New York City from 2001 to 2022. And it was while there that he began a history blog, which he called Paperless History. That was in 2016. I don't know if you younger listeners know what a blog is, but blogs were a thing for a time. In September 2022, he then, after leaving Friends, he rebranded the site as a subscription newsletter called Liberating Narratives. And, in the interview, we will definitely discuss newsletter in much greater detail to come. But I'll just say for now, and you'll, again, hear much more about it, it's really an incredible resource for world history instructors, whether just starting out or more experienced instructors who are just looking for new approaches to their classes. So without further ado, welcome, Bram.
Hello, hello.
It's great to have you on. I know it's been a long time, but we've been talking about this. We actually met you at AHA in January and started talking from there on Twitter, then text and conversations. But since that time, you've been all around the world. And so let's just start by talking about your travel, because I think that's pretty fundamental to who you are and the work you do. So where have you been over the last 6-7 months?
Okay, so I guess I'm just going to go back a little bit further here,
okay,
to the fall, because I think that's where sort of like my travels that really shape what I've been writing about began. Right. So back in October, I went to West Africa. And so I spent about a month traveling in Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, and Senegal. And I went for like sort of two main reasons. I wanted to see some sites connected with decolonization, and more importantly, to see sites connected with the transatlantic slave trade. Mm-hmm. And then came home, was home for a little bit writing, then went to Southeast Asia in February and March of this year. I was in Indonesia, Singapore, and Malaysia. And then on the way home, we had a layover in South Korea. And so I spent 5 days in Seoul.
Nice.
And then the last big trip was in April and May. Flew to Morocco. We started in Marrakesh, worked our way overland through Morocco and then took a ferry across from Tangier to Spain. We're just in southern Spain for a few days, and I went over to Portugal, worked my way up Portugal and to Porto, where I then set out to walk the Camino from Porto to Santiago de Compostela. And yeah, that's what I've done in a little less than a year.
That's pretty good. That's a lifetime of travel. That's more than a lifetime of travel for a lot of people.
I'm well aware.
Yeah. The Pilgrims Route is something I had a professor in grad school who did that. And since then, I've been dying to do that. So I'm a little jealous that you got to do that so recently, too. That's very, very cool. Now, obviously, you don't need to be an historian to have a passion for travel. But can you talk a little bit about how the fact that you are an historian informs your travels, and maybe, you know, conversely or relatedly, how does your travel inform your sense of history? Because, you know, when we get to talking about, liberating narratives, I think it very much feeds into the stuff you write. But I'd like to hear you talk about that a little bit.
So let's start off with just first how history informs my travel. So at the most basic level, it means just this like ever-growing list of places that I want to visit and to see. So much of what I read about, like I just start to imagine what would it be like to see that place. And so I'm always thinking about places to go. On a deeper level, though, I think what history really does is it shapes the way that I interact with people, how I see the places that I'm visiting. And I think like a good example of this is when I went to West Africa. So before I traveled to Ghana, I read Sadia Hartman's Lose Your Mother. Mm-hmm. And it really got me just sort of thinking about like the whole experience of what does it mean to travel to West Africa to learn about the slave trade and the roots of slavery. And I was sort of very conscious of the way in which it's been turned into a tourist industry in certain senses, the different types of people who are traveling there. And it made me just try to be a whole lot more sort of mindful of what I was seeing, how I was interacting and talking to people. And I think one of the best ways that I could sort of like highlight that was why I was in Cape Coast. I ended up hanging out a lot in this local Rastafarian restaurant. Mm-hmm. And it happened to be like one of the best places for vegetarian food. But what was really sort of great was a lot of the local guys who were either guides or selling souvenirs to tourists during the day all ended up hanging out there each evening drinking. And so I ended up spending each evening for about 4 days just chatting with them. And they were really curious about sort of like what I was doing there, why I was staying so long. They were surprised that I didn't like many white tourists to come to Ghana, like sort of drop in for a day, quickly see the castles and then disappear. And each evening, the conversations just sort of got deeper and deeper. And they really enjoyed sort of like hearing like my awareness of like the history of the slave trade and what it meant for Ghana, but also the fact that I wanted to take the time to hear their stories, to think about the continuing legacies. And I think that's one of the things that history has really done for my travel is it's made me able to connect with people whom I'm meeting and interacting with on a much deeper level. When people start to see that I'm familiar with their history, when I know about their culture, when I sit down and eat food with them, they start to open up more and more. And so it makes the experience much deeper.
Yeah, that's very cool. I want to just mention a few of your posts. And again, we will talk more about liberating narratives in a second in more detail. But one is when you're in Southeast Asia, because you do go, obviously, when you go to these places, you want to go to a lot of the key sites, but you seem very attuned to wanting to see stuff that's particularly interesting to an historian. And one example of that was when you went to when you went to Malacca, which is, if you know your world history, it's a really key point in kind of particularly early modern global trade, but it's not such a important site now, we'll just say, right? It's been surpassed by places like Singapore, for instance, which has a kind of similar role. as Malacca once had. So can you talk about going to Malacca, which is, I would argue, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, not a tourist site at this point, and what you're able to gain from going there.
It is sort of a tourist site, but not in the way that you might think. Like, it's become a place where lots of Chinese families from Singapore will go for a long weekend away. Okay. It is their like weekend escape. And then there's also Chinese families from mainland China who are traveling there for slightly longer trips. And so there's definitely fewer Western tourists going there, but there's a whole lot more of sort of other types of tourism. And, you know, like just this was actually my third trip to Malacca. And so it really is a place that just it's incredible because the history is everywhere, but it is definitely not something that most of the people are there to learn about. Even, you know, the handful of other Westerners that you meet who are passing through on some like Southeast Asian backpacking odyssey, it's really clear that they're not there with any intention of like learning about Dutch trade.
Yes, that, I guess that's what I meant more when I said it's not a tourist site. It's not like going to Borobudur or something like that, you know, a place you have to go for these historical reasons. But you being there, you know, absolutely fired your historical imagination a bit, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's impossible not to. Like when you're sitting there, you know, and walking up hills and climbing through Portuguese like church ruins and you know, in the museums, it's everywhere. And that's what's so great about it.
Yeah. And just for background for people who don't know about it, this was a city that you know, was famously one of the more cosmopolitan places probably in the entire world in the 15th century. You can read descriptions of it. Tomé Pérez, I think, has a description of it, a Portuguese merchant traveler. And you can find other descriptions as well, but just an incredible place. And so what are some you mentioned the Portuguese, you know, churches and things like that. What are some other historical elements there that maybe would escape a less discerning eye?
Well, there is an old water wheel that has been rebuilt. So it's not the original remains, but this was actually one of the things that when I first visited, it was still some of the older remains were there. And so these water wheels were something that were developed, you know, we don't even know exactly when, but before Europeans arrived in Malacca, you have this whole trade, you know, that Muslims are leading, and there's a spread of technology along with this trade. And so things like water wheels is an incredible way to sort of see this. So like one of the most famous examples of these Arab water wheels is in Cordoba in Spain. Mm-hmm. And then you go to the other end of Afro-Eurasia and you get to see a similar style water wheel that also was, you know, connected to Arab traders in Malacca. So I think that's like a really good example of something that like you're not really going there to see or no one's going to there, but it just really hints at the sort of connections and the importance of the city.
Right. This exchange of technology all the way from west to east. And it's, you know, what you said at the beginning is very cool as well. It's one of these things that we don't even know the origin point of necessarily. There's no quote unquote inventor we can find. And yet we see this dissemination through cross-cultural contact across this enormous part of the world. You know, for anybody who thinks globalization is a contemporary issue only, we can see elements like this playing out throughout history. Another bit of travel, and maybe you can remind me which post this was in so our listeners can find it. Was traveling in Central Asia, another place where, you know, in traditional world history, like it's so important for a time and then it just kind of, you know, it goes away and you don't talk about it any longer. So when you traveled in, you know, basically on the old Silk Roads, what were you able to discover at least, you know, for yourself in terms of how that travel informed your thinking?
So that was a trip I did way back in 2016. I was on sabbatical that year, and it was like a big part of like sort of doing this. So there was getting to see all of the remains of like the Timurid Empire and Samarkand was really amazing. You know, it's one of these sort of moments in world history that it's a huge empire, it disappears so quickly. And even now, like world history textbooks will skip over it. But when you go to Samarkand, it's everywhere. Like these ruins are unbelievable. Same with Bukhara as well. And so there's that element. But what I really was like amazed by was sort of the experience of traveling overland from Kyrgyzstan into China. And you'll read about like the difficulties, how hard it was for travelers, thinking about sort of just like the movement. And when you actually do it, like there's no way to imagine how someone did this a thousand years ago. I mean, you're traveling, like I traveled in like the back of a little like minibus that was full of just like workers who travel across the border, chain smoking away. Meanwhile, there's a blizzard going on around us. We're flying along at probably like about 100 kilometers an hour on this mountain pass that's just like, I'm just like so afraid of falling off. And you're just no one else going through except trucks back and forth, either carrying workers or carrying goods, and then going across the border into China. And then at that point too, like I rode in a big semi truck with a driver because I got through so quickly and he just like called me aboard. And so it was this crazy day of just like imagining, like I did something that probably I covered about around like 100 kilometers of distance in, you know, the course of the day. And I'm thinking about like, how did traders, you know, get across those 100, 150 kilometers, you know, on horseback or, you know, on camelback or walking? And like, that was one of those moments where you really start to think about just sort of the challenges of these trade routes and movement of goods that were just like, this was a trade route that like, wasn't only popular for like a few years. I mean, we're talking thousands of years of history and people moving goods across these mountaintops.
And entire cities and you know, societies forming based around the wealth of that trade. Yeah, I mean, that's such a cool example of just how difficult it is even now when you have trucks and semis and then trying to imagine. Yeah. I don't know if you read, have you read Fa Xian, the Chinese monk?
Yes.
Travels? Yes. I mean, so you get a sense there because he's talking about the dangers of that route in terms of these, you know, you kind of, they almost mysticize these things. They turn them into, you know, the breath of the dragon and, you know, all these ghosts and spirits and these things. But, you know, it's just a way of making sense of these tremendous natural difficulties of travel. So what, if you could, can you remind me what, when that, that post was from, and point our readers toward it? Cause it's one of the
Oh my gosh. I feel like that was probably been a monthly digest when I mentioned that.
Okay.
You know, so those are ones that are available to anyone. I can double check and I'll make sure that you can like put the link for that in the notes.
Great.
Yep.
So let's turn to liberating narratives because you at AHA, you handed me a link to it and I went to it and I've been reading it ever since. And I do really want to recommend it to our listeners. For teachers in particular, I think it's amazing. And I think just for historically curious people, we'll call them, it's a really fascinating read. You send out posts. Is it weekly when you're not traveling quite as much?
I have been almost, every week, at least one a week. I took a little break for the Camino and then I got kind of backed up, but I'm just about caught up. So yeah, it has been a week, every week. And then there's a weekly main post. There's two posts that come out on the beginning of each month and the middle of each month that's for everyone. And then I also have actually a new set of posts that are come out also weekly, where it's just a quick excerpt from a primary source or a visual source that's very much geared to being used in the classroom. Yes. So yeah, multiple times a week.
It's really impressive. The discipline it takes for that is substantial. Let's just talk about the site. So taking it from your about page, you say Liberating Narratives is my offering to the many world history teachers struggling to teach in a more inclusive and transformative manner. I write about how we can challenge Eurocentric interpretations of and decolonize world history pedagogy in the classroom. And you're absolutely doing that. But I'm wondering, you know, when you started, because you know, as I said in the introduction, you were teaching for, I think, 21 years, mm-hmm. world history that whole time? Is that, did you?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Was there a point in that time where you came to really understand the limitations of the way world history was being taught? We talked, I think it was that last episode about skeleton keys. Was there a kind of moment or an encounter you had that really opened up these doors to seeing some of the problems and some of the things you needed to do to present a better kind of world history?
Yeah. So when I started at Friends, I was really lucky because Friends Seminary has sort of a long history of teaching world history. Her name's Jean Johnson, who wrote a text called The Human Drama. And she was the woman who introduced world history to Friends Seminary. She was working a lot with folks like Ross Dunn in the 1980s to really sort of develop world history. And so I got to know her. She had recently retired, but was still in contact with teachers at the school. And so on one hand, she was key for me, like just like thinking about things in a whole new way. But then there was also another teacher who was teaching like the second half to the world history sequence, but essentially was teaching a Western civilization plus the occasional like, you know, dalliance into something world historical. Like China, and so usually, right away. Exactly. And so right away, like it just got me thinking about like, okay, this is not like how world history should be taught. Yeah. I had these two sort of like, you know, colleagues doing things in such different ways. And so that made me just start to realize, and this was a big, you know, part of sort of, I think so much of the scholarship in world history in the 90s and early 2000s was like how to get out of the sort of Western civilization model and how to sort of start being more inclusive. But what I also noticed was it was even then like limited ways in which you include other people's voices. It was still the sort of, you know, special box approach that textbooks are famous for, you know, the end of the chapter. Here's, oh, by the way, here's what we forgot to include. And I wanted to figure out how do you take those parts of the story that's in the special box and center that for the students? You know, what do I need to do to make this like far more a part of the main narrative rather than just this aside, which students quickly forget? Like, I mean, I think every teacher, every professor knows that like, if the students are even reading everything they give you, they're skipping over the stuff in the boxes.
Yes, because you know, that's what the textbook is telling you to do, right? They put it in a box for a reason. I think in the past, we've called this, I think, like contributionism or something like that. I don't remember the term we've used, but this idea that like there's a main story, but then these people also contributed to the story as well. And, you know, it's a handy way of saying this is what they did, and that's the sum total of what they did as well. Now we can safely stop talking about them. So yeah, that text box history is a dangerous one, definitely.
Yeah. So like one of the key moments where I really started to dig into like, how do I do this was when I was asked to be on the AP World History Curriculum Review. I forget the exact name of this committee, but this was back in 2008. And so this was the first sort of major review of AP World History. And there was a pretty big switch that we made from this sort of like just list of names and dates and people that needed to be included to introducing what became known as like key concepts and illustrative examples. And the whole thinking behind that was like, I wanted to help teachers find ways to center different stories that like, you know, we didn't have to just use the standard narrative. We could use broader concepts and choose examples from all over the world, different people's stories. And you could think about who your own students were, your own passions, and figure out how to weave in these different stories into the main narrative of world history. And so that was like this great moment where like it seemed like the College Board was really open and receptive. And then a few years later, I think it was like around 2017 or so, when the College Board then completely backtracked and cut off everything before 1200 and also narrowed the scope of world history. And that was really huge for me, and like basically just pissing me off and wanting to write more. It's when right around the same time that I started Liberating Narratives as a blog, I had just had done so shortly before that. And it just really was this sort of energy, like, no, like we need to help teachers have more stories that aren't sort of your typical stories, more one centered on Asian and African and Indigenous voices, because the reason the College Board claimed to do this was that teachers were complaining world history was too hard to teach, that there were too many things. And so we narrowed it, which meant making it more Eurocentric. Yes. And so that was really the kind of the moment. To the part about like skeleton keys that like open things up, it's sort of a funny one, is that it's food for me. Being a person who travels and tries things all over the world and also loving to cook, I was like constantly amazed by some of these dishes that I would start to eat and starting to try to figure out the story. So like one of them is a South Indian dish known as Pav Bhaji. And this is a dish that's served on what looks like the rolls that many Americans have at Thanksgiving, but with this tomato-based curry on it. And I just remember eating it the first time and going like, where's this dish come from? And then I started to like do a little reading and research and started to realize that pav is the Portuguese word for bread. And what you have here is this dish, which is like a staple dish in Bombay, you know, sometimes referred to as Mumbai, that people are eating all of the time. And like you see this legacy of Portuguese colonization in Goa there. And so often foods that are such a part of what we eat today around the world are entry points for thinking about historical exchanges and interactions. And that's something that just like I love to sort of get into. It's also something that I'll bring into the classroom all of the time as a way to open up a topic for students.
Right, because it's very approachable, right? It's something we've all experienced in ways big and small, and you can see those connections, the movement of ingredients, the movement of spices, the movement of cooking styles. So yeah, that's a very cool one. So let's connect more to some of your recent posts, and we can go back to the Indian Ocean, mm-hmm. because that's what you've been writing about, I believe, in your last two or three posts. What is it about that region that you think gets overlooked or under-discussed? And, you know, what are some things we can do to highlight maybe a different way of seeing the Indian Ocean, which, you know, again, as I said before, about Central Asia or even about Malacca, there's this tendency to see parts of the world in this very kind of global and interconnected way, right up until the point where Europeans become involved, and then it becomes a different kind of history. So what can we do in terms of the Indian Ocean to see it as a region that continues to be interesting and important for reasons other than the presence of Europeans?
So there's... how to like sort of even get this? This is one of those topics that, like, because of travel, it became so obvious to me that, like, the Indian Ocean as like a zone of interaction and exchange is still very much alive. When you're traveling along like the east coast of Africa and you hear Arabic and Hindi loanwords for numbers and all sorts of things going on, like when you're seeing similar foods, architectural styles across it, like it just becomes so quickly apparent that there's a whole network of exchange and transfer that is about the indigenous inhabitants of the region and not just simply, like, for example, Pav Bhaji, where they're taking bread. And so that was really kind of the jumping off point. And like in thinking about like what needs to sort of be a little bit different in how we teach us, is this very, what I would think of as like a very artificial line that so many discussions of the Indian Ocean takes, where 1498 is everything changes.
Yes.
Vasco da Gama did not step off that boat and completely end one era in the Indian Ocean and start another. In fact, like what I've been writing about here is like all of these continuities, which you can see in the Indian Ocean that were well established before 1498 and continue to be important. Like the most obvious one is just simply like the centrality of Islam in the Indian Ocean zone. And, you know, thinking about how Islam continues to be the fastest growing religion throughout the region, the role of Arabic as like sort of the default language for so much of the trade and exchange that's taking place, you know, even as the Portuguese and the Dutch come into what we think of today as Indonesia, and they're trying to take over the trade. At the same time, more and more people are learning Arabic to read the Quran.
Yeah.
And we can think about like the spread of Arabic and how it affects the development of the Malay language. And so here is supposedly, you know, the Dutch colonizing this region. And yet, you know, it's not Dutch that is becoming the main language of all of the Muslims throughout the Indonesian island and the archipelago. So I think that like that's a good example of sort of what's getting overlooked, because this is unfortunately the problem with a lot of world history is we're really good about kind of pointing to change and we forget like continuities and how to help our students see that, you know, and that centrality of Islam continues through the 19th century. I just finished a post that will be going out tomorrow, actually, about the 19th century and thinking about how the number of people going on pilgrimage to Mecca increases dramatically because of the opening of the Suez Canal and the development of steamships. So like something that was intended to facilitate European imperialism and develop like resource extraction becomes, you know, also something that Muslims take advantage of to go in huge numbers to start traveling to Mecca to go on pilgrimage. And, you know, you can find these sorts of things throughout the Indian Ocean. I think it's like a good entry point. I don't know if there's something you want to follow up on there.
No, it's a really great example because, you know, I think even in some textbooks that are not quite as good at this sort of thing or seeing the world in this way you're suggesting, I think most would also say that the main cultural impact of the European presence was the introduction of Christianity, right? Or at least we can say that's the main way in which they attempted to change the culture of the region was through the introduction of Christianity, especially with the Portuguese and their missions and things of that nature. But the fact that at the same time they're introducing Christianity, the religion that's actually growing and spreading fastest is Islam, is a pretty remarkable fact. And then you can add to that as well, the idea of change and continuity is that, you know, what we kind of see as change as historians looking back and looking at big eras. I think your first post is 16th, 17th century about Indian Ocean, and then you do 17th, 18th. Is that right? Mm-hmm. You know, so it's one thing to look at those big eras and you can identify, well, in 1800, things were different than in 1600. But that's not necessarily the experience of the people in the region living their lives, right? They're not seeing change occurring in a way that they recognize happening every single day. There's this kind of slow, steady set of changes that over time lead to a different kind of world, but not one that's just constructed by European presence. It's one that, like it always has been, it's constructed through a process of interaction and exchange that is unequal at times. But you can also make the case that, you know, the Indian Ocean impacted Europeans as much as Europeans impacted the Indian Ocean in ways as well. Can you talk, you give this example of the Omani Empire, which I really liked, and it kind of fits into both this idea of the continuing importance of Islam, but also speaks to the fact that it's not just 1498 Europeans show up and quote unquote conquer, but that there is a kind of give and take. There's ebbs and flows in terms of the political domination of Europeans. At some points it's greater and some points it's lesser. I always think of this map that shows you know, the Portuguese presence in the Indian Ocean in 1600, and it looks really impressive because you can see all these dots you know, all around the Indian Ocean, and then you realize that, like, within, you know, 10 years, I don't know, maybe 20 years, 75% of those dots would disappear, or at least that the Portuguese presence in those places would disappear. So talk about the Omani Empire a little bit and what it kind of says about the Indian Ocean and that process of European presence and the limitations of that presence, I guess, as well.
Yeah. So I first learned about the Omani Empire when Felipe Fernandez Armesto published a world history textbook. It's called like The World of History.
Yeah,
and it was a text. Yeah, it was like a textbook that didn't catch on really for many teachers, but it was really like fascinating, like in terms of some of the examples he was using. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it a lot. And that was where I read about the Omani Empire for the first time. And it just blew my mind because I had no clue about the Omani Empire. Right. And just wanted to start reading more. And it was so hard to find resources about it for world history teachers. And then shortly after I read that was when I traveled down the East African coast. This is back in 2011, I think. And all of a sudden, like, you start seeing all of this stuff in museums and, you know, historical sites about the influence and the legacy of the Omanis. And especially once you get to Zanzibar there, you know, which was the capital of the Omani Empire for a while, which like to me is one of the things that really like stood out, that like the Omanis, you know, take control of these territories from the Portuguese, and they're governing them, you know, very loosely at first from Muscat, but then, you know, decide let's actually relocate the capital of the empire to Zanzibar because that makes more sense. And it speaks to just how important that trade is still in the Indian Ocean, you know, like to decide to relocate the entire capital struck me as one of these things that we're missing out of a story here. And, you know, the narrative that's in the textbook is as sort of, you know, I mentioned, and you got to like the Portuguese come in, they're around, but then the Dutch and the English come in and they eventually displace the Portuguese. And like this idea that an indigenous empire emerges, displaces the Portuguese, and basically, you know, governs the western reach of the Indian Ocean for about a century and then works with the British for another half century, you know, before the empire is finally sort of falls apart. I just was amazed by this. And like, why is this not getting included in the story? And so how, like, that was one of those moments where also just stood out that like how we're teaching the Indian Ocean is something's missing. And the fact that there's still so much indigenous influence in terms of what's getting traded and even how government works is being overlooked.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned Felipe Fernandez Armesto. I'm glad you did, because it just made me realize that another example sort of similar to that is, do you remember he has something about a Portuguese captain named Geronimo de Quadros? Remember that story he tells?
I don't remember offhand.
You don't remember that? Okay, so he's this captain of this tiny Portuguese base in the Persian Gulf. And he goes to Ormuz, which is the regional, you know, Portuguese fort. And he basically makes a petition back to Portugal for help because he's trying to run this fort. And he says, I have no money. And you're only paying me to keep 12 soldiers, but I need at least 30. And I got to pay him out of pocket. And he talks about, you know, we build the walls of the fort. And every year it rains and the walls, because they're made of mud, melt, and I got to pay for bowstrings and I got to pay for opium just to keep people happy. And it's this plea for, you know, some kind of aid from the Portuguese crown. And we don't know what happens with the petition. There's no record of a response or anything like that, but pretty clearly the fort does disappear within a few years. And it again speaks to this problem of using terms like conquest, which you talk about in, I think it's the first of these posts. So maybe can you go a little into that idea of conquest and the limitations of that term and trying to make sense of the Indian Ocean? And I think we see it in other places. I think also, you know, sometimes talk about the British quote unquote conquest of India doesn't fully explain what's happened or the long-term process of expansion that the British have in South Asia either. But specifically for the Indian Ocean, why is conquest maybe not the best way to think about what's happening?
So before I talk about the conquest in the Indian Ocean, like I did a post, it was, I think the last post that I wrote for Liberating Notice before I converted to the subscription model, about the failure of the Portuguese and Spanish to conquer the Americas in the 16th century.
Yeah.
And it was one of these moments where like we, that is like the perfect example of what's in every textbook, this incredible amount of material about the way in which the Americas are conquered. Mm-hmm. And yet, like when you start to look a little more closely, you realize, well, the Spanish and the Portuguese control such a tiny, small amount of territory, you know, these cities right along the coast. And meanwhile, like the number of examples of indigenous peoples in the Americas and even like the first enslaved Africans being brought over are just rebelling left and right. Yes. And this idea that like they've conquered with like this as something that's happened in the past is just a joke, because they're constantly trying to just even hold on for dear life.
Yes.
And so there's like an ongoing moment of working with locals, coming up with agreements, know, to sort
it's
of
a negotiation, a constant negotiation. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's like the much better way to think about it. Yeah. And so that same concept is very much there in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah. Well, let me say one thing before we get to the Indian Ocean, because you just went right in my wheelhouse here. So my dissertation was called Discoveries Are Not to Be Called Conquests, after a famous order from King Philip II. Because, you know, that's what he's saying, that you keep showing up in these places and calling them conquests when you're just like kind of showed up and you have a presence there. And he wanted to stop the Spanish from doing that because it was causing all kinds of problems. But when I was in the archives in Seville, I found a petition from a local indigenous elite. I think this is in Mexico. This is in the viceroyalty of Peru. And it was he was deceased. And so this was his wife writing the petition, or at least putting the petition forward. And basically what she was saying is, you know, my family, we can trace our family back. This was 1571, I guess. So it's, you know, 40 years after Pizarro shows up. And she said, you know, my family can trace our lineage back to the arrival of the Spanish in the first place. And we were allies of Pizarro and the Spaniards who showed up. And so we were allies in the conquest. And now we're being treated as if we're conquered people. And so I think that's a good way of thinking about what's happening here, is that the Spanish, to the extent they conquered, they did so as a collaboration with all kinds of local indigenous people. And over time, you know, they started treating, you know, the idea of Indians becomes a classification, and Indian essentially came to mean, or Indio came to mean essentially a conquered person. And so you're seeing this process by which people who thought they were contributors and collaborators in a process now found themselves referred to as conquered people, or treated as conquered people in a way that fundamentally didn't make sense to them. And you see, you know, again, that negotiation happening where they're, you know, they're free to make these petitions. And in theory, I think that letter actually, Philip had transcribed something written in the margins of it as well. So it's just a cool example of how that process, again, doesn't show up as this single moment of conquest, but it's this slow process of, you know, growing Spanish power, of negotiation, of changing status, of emerging identities, of you know, a really complex thing that goes beyond just show up and impose authority. Sorry, I had to get that in because you.
Yeah, no, it's great. I was going to say, I mean, it's so relevant. I'm almost embarrassed I've pointed out this post, because now, like, I mean, this was like when I was still sort of writing casually, as opposed to trying to turn it into my job. And it's a terrible post, so I look in sense, but it's, the ideas were there. And so, like, when I think about these concepts and about what like matters in the Indian Ocean, is this idea that conquest is negotiated, like it gets completely lost in all of the maps that we use in world history textbooks to talk about Europeans, you know, in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. They're terrible. I mean, even the ones that like I publish on the website, like I feel embarrassed by half the time, because they're suggesting that something happened and it's done and the process is over, when it's not. And one of the places where like I tried to really highlight this was with the English in Bombay in the late 17th century. So at this point, like, the English have been in the Indian Ocean almost a century. They, you know, have an existing relationship with the Mughals from trading at Surat. And they then get what will become Bombay from the Portuguese and decide they're going to relocate the whole capital of sort of their trading setup on the western coast of India to Bombay. And they do this, and it just blows up in their face. You know, they piss off the locals. They get involved in these conflicts between local elites who are already struggling with the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb. And ultimately, like, Aurangzeb orders in, like, one of the local elites, and they just completely defeat the British. You know, the English have to surrender, they have to pay indemnities, they have to pay damages. I mean, it was incredible when I first read about it, because, like, we talk about that exact setup at the end of the Opium War, of like what the British do to the Chinese, and like you're reading about what happens here, you know, in 1689, that, like, here's the British paying to Surat, merchants from Surat, for the damages to their ships. Here's what they're paying to the Mughal authorities. Here's what they're agreeing to. And you're just like, wow, like, the English can't do anything at this point. Like, you know, they are completely at the mercy of what the local powers want. And yet, if you look at a map, you know, there's like a nice solid dot there. Bombay, you know, English colony, trading port.
Well, it's funny. Yeah, it's funny because students, you know, when you, when, because I teach the, this Asian history, teach the Asian history survey, you know, they always want to know, well, so why did the quote unquote Indians, because they refer to them just as, you know, as a category. Why did the Indians allow the British to be there? It's like, because they didn't matter, right? Or they, let's put it a different way. They were not a threat in any way. They're barely there. They're important for trade. They probably bring in some wealth, but they're not, you know, a rival in any way. They would not have seen them as a rival at that point. There were bigger problems to face. And it's funny. I don't think this is strictly for our students, but it can be really hard. I always say that the biggest problem with doing history is the present is a spoiler for the past, right? We already know how things work out, and it becomes hard, therefore, to think of the past as something, you know, fundamentally different from where we are now. And the idea that anybody would say, well, we can't let these people in because 300 years from now, they're going to become really powerful and we won't have to be able to stop them. but I mean, that example is so great. And it really pushes back against this idea of this, you know, this steady growth of the British presence unproblematically from port to port, from territory to territory, until inevitably, you know, I don't know, the Battle of Plassey happens and then it's all downhill from there. It is a push and pull. It is a series of victories and defeats and humiliations and all that, that eventually does lead to something more significant, but it takes a long time to get there. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I can also mention, like, one other example that I wanted to include in writing about the Portuguese, but I actually left out because the posts just get too long.
Yes.
And when you mentioned Hormuz, it reminded me of, you know, so the Portuguese, they're trying to control so much territory, and they're failing miserably, as like that letter that you mentioned highlights. They can't do it. And lots of the Portuguese sailors, they just basically start realizing, like, this job sucks. Like, I don't want to try to, like, enforce this huge control over all of the Indian Ocean. You're at sea all of the time. You know, it's not a pleasant life. And a lot of them start just sort of disappearing when they're on shore leave. And, like, one of the good examples of this is in the area, like, of where the Rohingya are in modern day, like, Myanmar or Burma, what was known as, like, the Kingdom of Arakan in the late 16th, like, early 17th century. And the Portuguese just start to sort of, like, settle there and merge with the local community, some of them, and become slavers, capturing locals and selling them eventually to, like, the Dutch for, you know, as the Dutch begin to establish their colonies. But if you go to, it's a city known as Bishnupur, I think I'm pronouncing this, in Calcutta today, there's these temples that are being made in the 17th century by the local elites. And most of the temples have illustrations of scenes from, like the life of Krishna or of, Shiva and Ganesh. It's like typical scenes you would find in the temple. But then there's this one section where it shows these Portuguese and Aracanese slavers in boats that are clearly local to the Indian Ocean. They're modeled after Chinese like dragon ships raiding the coasts for slaves. And you realize like there's all of these Portuguese who are just like, I don't want to try to like be continue part of this Portuguese empire. Like it's just easier to carve out a living with working with the locals. Yes. And it's awful because it's slaving, but it's like you really can see it and everyone knows because it's very clearly like they're depicted in these murals, like in clothing that is recognizably European.
Yeah. No, it's a great example. I think there's something kind of similar where all these, particularly as the Mughal Empire began, breaking apart a little bit, a lot of the local rulers would have European artillery men, yep. In their army. So you'd have this kind of mixed ethnic army with Europeans kind of having a specialized role as artillery. And that these are all guys who just realized that working for the home kingdom was not worth it. They basically defected or not even defect. Maybe that's not the right way to think of it. They made a rational choice about a better way to live their lives. And that was not by maintaining their connection with their home kingdom. We could talk about this for two more hours, but let's get into just the newsletter, right? Is that what we call the Burden Arrows, a newsletter? Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the newsletter because it kind of speaks to something that's, I think, really important right now, which is that the academic job market obviously is in collapse or continuing to collapse, perpetually in collapse, maybe, because I was told it was in collapse when I was looking for a job 20 years ago. But I think more and more historians, given the dire nature of the job market, are thinking about what they can do to stay connected to history, even if those jobs in academia are not available any longer or less available than they used to be. And what you've done is you've carved out a place where you can do this really cool and interesting history outside of the traditional places maybe that history gets done. So can you talk about, or do you have advice maybe for historians who are looking for an alternative to classroom teaching, whether for whatever reason, because I think you built something really cool with Liberating Narratives.
First, thanks. I appreciate that. When I get compliments from, folks who are in the classroom, whether it's at the college or high school level, it's just the thing that keeps me going. And so like advice to do this, I mean, what's really crazy is I actually had what most folks would consider like an amazing high school teaching job.
Yeah.
I had so much freedom in the classroom. I was teaching great students. And even in that context, COVID and, U.S. government policy has just done a number on what it means to teach in this country. Yes. The way of sort of the day-to-day experience in the class just got tougher and tougher. And I realized I needed to take a break for my own sanity and just peace of mind. And so like the first piece of advice like that comes out of this is you have to be willing to take risks. I didn't need to do this. It was something I kind of wanted to do. And I made the choice to, sort of leave what was, one, secure and safe career for a very different kind of opportunity. And so like taking chances, but is a big part of it. The other piece of advice is like this project is very much like the culmination of so many of my passions from different phases in my life. And so finding a way to tap into like what gets you excited. Like when I think about how do I crank out, 3,000 words a week, sometimes even I'm doing like two posts, like up to like 5,000 words a week. It's because I enjoy it. Yes. I really get lost sometimes looking at, source books and reading articles, and you have to love it. You have to kind of want to read some more and just kind of focus at it. The other, sort of piece of advice I would say is be willing to make mistakes. You know, I think one of the trickiest things with as a teacher working with students, but also as professionals, is we're so reluctant to just sort of put something out there. Like, we want it to be perfect and polished. You know, this is part of the reason why I dropped out of graduate school when I did, was I was really turned off by some of the aspects of academia, where it just was like pushing and pushing. Like, what did your research paper have to look like? It had to be perfect. And I wasn't sure like that was the right focus. And I see it with students who are afraid now to turn in essays because it's not perfect. They want everything right. And one of the things that like I have to tell myself when writing each week is I just want to put it out there. Like, I know I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to miss things at times. I'm going to overlook something. And if I had spent like another 2 months on any post, yeah, it would be better. But that's not going to help teachers or students in that way. And so part of it with, I think, is that's really key for folks trying to do something is accepting that like, this is a process. It's not meant to be complete and perfect, that like we can put stuff out there and revise it and refine it. And, you know, there's some of the topics that I've talked about on Liberating Narratives over the years that I've refined, and you can sort of see the paper trail of how I've come back at topics and rethought how to introduce it, how to weave it into the classroom. And so I think that's one of the really key pieces of advice, is to like be willing to make mistakes.
That's really fair. I think that's really, really important. You spoke earlier about, you know, talking about a post that was about quote unquote conquest of the Americas that now you look back on and don't like so much, but that's such a fundamental experience of putting things out in the world, is that the things you did 5 years ago are never going to be as satisfying to you, you know, in the present. There's always things you miss. There's always things that maybe embarrass you a little bit, but you would not be better now if you hadn't made those mistakes in the past or done things that you don't necessarily believe any longer. It's why publishing is really scary, right? because when it's published and it's out in the public, you know, that's who you are at that point from then on. But I think you're absolutely right. Get stuff out there, get stuff on the page to begin with, but then don't be so precious about, you know, perfecting it before it's published. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's really key, especially for teachers, because like, if all we expected from our students was perfectly crafted essays, like, forget it. Like, we're never going to get that. So why would we hold ourselves to this standard, which we also know is like unobtainable?
Yeah.
I would just add like one other sort of fun thing about it. And I don't have this on my bio so much, but I grew up as like a punk teenager, being in bands and traveling around the country and doing zines. And a big part of like what's shaped my approach to how I've done this, like why I chose to do it like a self-publishing venture, is that sort of love of just putting something out there and seeing how people respond to it. You know, it's why I didn't want to do it via Substack, that I used a different sort of provider, this provider known as Ghost, which is, you know, set up really for me to just like reimagine these days when I would like be putting together crappy photocopies in a Kinko's, but now I'm trying to do it in a better way for teachers. And so like the other piece of advice is like, think about where your passions are, you know, how you can channel those a bit into these other projects that, you know, yes, I can do the really formal lessons, you know, for some major company for new materials for, you know, how to teach world history, but that really isn't who I am as a person. Like, right. I wanted something that reflects who I am as a person, you know, that gives me the freedom to tell wacky travel stories about, you know, trying to cross the mountains from Kyrgyzstan into China or things like that, you know, because they actually catch people's attention.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I almost feel like we need to take a sidebar now so you can explain what a zine is to our non-90s kids, but we'll go further into that. But this might be a conversation for us off mic. So the newsletter, by the way, is liberatingnarratives.com. You can go, there's public posts, and then you can subscribe for additional posts as well. And I just want to say, you know, I've complimented it throughout, but one of the things I really like about your post is just the range of materials you're drawing from. You take excerpts from textbooks, from traditional world history textbooks. You've got great primary sources, both written and images as well. The maps you've talked about, as imperfect as those maps are, they are able to, get different conversations and discussions going. And then you also, I think very impressively, are very up on current literature as well. And so, you know, again, for those who are historians and in the classroom, for those who just really like this stuff, I absolutely recommend getting on liberatingnarratives.com. And Bram, this has been a pleasure to talk to you. Hopefully we can get you on again in the future. Anything else you want to talk about or...
I have one other fun little project that I just want to highlight.
Awesome. Yeah.
There is also kind of this other thing I do with my wife, where if you have any interest in yoga and travel and also have history, we're trying to blend those things together. It's called Shared Pilgrimage. It can be found at sharedpilgrimage.com. And so this is something that we're doing our first retreat together at the end of September, and we're going to Morocco. And so we wanted to kind of, I guess in a sense, decolonize the yoga retreat by making it less about this exclusive escape and how can you get people to engage with the locals and learn about local culture and history a whole lot more while also being on retreat.
Awesome. So. I'm glad you I was gonna say something. I know you do these trips. I was gonna mention that. I'm glad you remembered. So thank you so much for being on, Bram. And like I said, we'd love to have you on again if there's more to talk about in the future.
Happily. Thank you, Josh. This was a great time to just sort of talk about what I'm doing. I appreciate it.
Well, hey, that was really fabulous, Josh. Well done. You know, you make it look easy. You know, just a couple of guys sitting around chewing the fat about, you know, extraordinarily significant sort of interests in the work that we do. You know, in other words, there's nothing particularly casual or simple, you know, about trying to teach and write about history against the grain. You know, you've been involved with the textbook project, Open Educational Resources, World History Textbook, which I'm happy to say is coming to fruition for you. We'll have some more of that future episodes.
Definitely.
I've been doing my own work and we've both been teaching forever like Bram. And we know it's not easy because these narratives once lodged are not easy to dislodge. And yet here you guys are talking about this in really accessible ways, really, I think, you know, endearing terms. I was so impressed with Bram's stories of global travel. And I was especially impressed by what he had to say of how that travel brought him face to face with the limitations of those traditional narratives. In other words, as he found himself in places like Malacca, for example, or other points of the Indian Ocean, East Africa, for example, you know, and seeing the ongoing presence of Islam, of Islamic mm-hmm. culture, not just the sort of, you know, religious orientation of Muslim people, but the whole suite of, you know, economic, cultural sort of, you know, values that go along with the historical development of Islam in the Indian Ocean, and realizing that that's not how the narratives of the West present it, you know, that you have Islam sort of noted at a point, but then what? I don't know, Vasco da Gama shows up and, you know, it all goes away or something. You know, you have the reconnaissance of the Indian Ocean by the Portuguese and the establishment of European empires, and you're very much into the narrative of the West at that point. Although if, I guess, what he was saying, as, you know, as he learned, if you touch down at any of those points now,
or then actually, right? Mm-hmm. If you, you know, Da Gama's voyage, 1498, if you touch down, say 2 years later, 5 years later in, you know, Mombasa or Sofala or one of these East African places, you know, or Malacca for that matter, and said, you know, what do you think of the Portuguese takeover?
Right.
The response would have likely been what?
Who are the Portuguese? What do you mean? What's going on? Yeah. No.
And I love how his travels brought that home to him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, kind of engaging with the world is part of what world history needs to be. And I enjoyed it because, you know, it helped remind me, and I'm aware of this, but every once in a while, you know, because you've been so eloquent in your critique of U.S. history, and it sometimes need reminding that world history has its own baggage, right? World history has its own SVH, as you call it, for U.S. history, its own standard version history. And there are a lot of ways we can help undermine that. And what's interesting about world history versus U.S. is that the resistance to new narratives in world history is much less than for U.S. history. I think there's a lot more room for us to play around. Yes. Without stepping on toes and getting people upset, because right. You know, there are people who are absolutely, you know, tied to the kind of rise of the West narrative, and that's kind of fundamental to how they think of things. But students certainly are not, it's not driven home as deeply in students as they grow up as that standard version history is in U.S. history. But all that said, you know, there's a lot of problems with the way world history gets taught, and even in these more quote unquote enlightened times, a lot of stories get through, a lot of narratives get through that fundamentally, I think, distort how we think of the grand sweep of world history. And as you note, as we talked about in the interview, the idea of conquest and hegemony, European hegemony, gets completely overstated for so many eras of world history. And it's really only probably by the late 19th century that there is real Western hegemony, rather, in a lot of these places where they had been for maybe centuries or generations or whatever. But it takes a long time to get there. And ignoring that fact, as I said, you know, really fundamentally distorts how we think about that deeper past. So, you know, it was really fun for me to talk with Bram, because I think we're kind of simpatico on a lot of these things. You know, him, touching on stuff that I talked about in the dissertation was also a fun little surprise as well. But, you know, there's work to do in world history, I guess, is my conclusion of listening back and doing the interview in real time as well.
Yeah, I mean, I like what you say. I mean, world history has the advantage of not having to carry the baggage of a nation state claim, you know, a sovereignty claim, right? The idea of doing history without borders, after all, suggests that your priorities can be other than constantly sanctifying, you know, some particular governing claim to sovereignty, you know, let's all stand and, you know, remove our caps and sing God bless America. You know, it's right. Like, no, you don't have that burden. And I think that's what's so beautiful. While we were both drawn into doing world history, you in graduate school and me, you know, after graduate school, and still believe that, absolutely. I mean, it's the tagline of our show, right? Is history without borders. But to the extent that, you know, we were all trained in this kind of Western system of history, that is the actual training of historians, you know, empiricism and, you know, sort of positivism and all this kind of stuff that comes out of the 19th century meant that a lot of what we were doing was going to be what we call sovereignty trap history. And I think, you know, world history has had its own version of that, you know, is if you spend your time reading the sovereignty documents, if you read the imperial documents of Portugal or Spain, like, you know, you did in your dissertation, right? Mm-hmm. Then you're going to find yourself in a discourse of power, you know, whereas what Brand is, and you've pointed out in your dissertation, how you found out that discourse, far from being, you know, what, you know, created through a kind of heavenly osmosis of something we call the past, was very much designed for imperial needs and all that kind of stuff. It's just that after a while, you forget that part, right? Yeah. You think it is something like universal or, you know, timeless or something. But I loved what, you know, to Bram had to say, because he's saying, yeah, but when you travel, that's not how you experience the travel. I mean, I guess when you go through the airport and they make you line up and, you get something like an administrative, authoritative, sovereign system at your, you know, in your face. But when you're out, you know, in the markets, right, or on the roads, I mean, he's traveling across the mountains of Western China, right?
Yeah.
In a bus, God knows, probably would not pass muster in, you know, some local school district here for transportation safety or something. You know, flying across these mountain roads with precipices, you know, coming dangerously close. You're not experiencing sovereignty at that history of sovereignty. You're experiencing people making a living. You're experiencing the landscape, you know, lives in connection, you know, migrant workers from one place next. And sure, you can always get to that level, that administrative level of power if you want to, because it's so wrapped around the systems we lived in. But your existential experience isn't necessarily that, is it? I mean, maybe if you get pulled over by some gendarme or something, or find yourself, you know, sitting in, you know, some, I don't know what, jail cell, or, you know, I mean, then you're interfacing with it. But it seems to me that what Brand was saying, you know, is that the basic human experience of connection, you know, and interconnection, and aspirations, and, you know, pride, you know, cultural, you know, wanting to share, you know, culture. That's just as much the marrow of our species' historical experience as those more formal sovereignty documents that so much of the history, including world history, you know, can be based on.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I had this idea in grad school, and I think I wrote something about it, but didn't pursue it further. But to make a contrast between these kind of what I've called macro encounters, which is like these encounters between quote unquote civilizations or states, mm-hmm. or, you know, these large entities, and that encounter, you know, can be read in certain ways, and it requires certain kinds of documents, and, you know, has these certain kinds of outcomes, you know. So you could talk about the Spanish encounter with the indigenous, with people of the Americas, something like that. But that's a very fundamentally different thing than this, what I call the micro encounters, right? The encounter mm-hmm. between individuals, mm-hmm. you know, fundamentally trying to survive, make sense of the world, find common ground, compete, whatever the case may be, mm-hmm. that those kind of micro encounters can't really be understood through the same logic of that macro encounter, right? And I think travel is a good way of kind of seeing that in our own lives as well. And, you know, going back to what you were saying about, you know, when they were eventually freed, I forget what the line was, you know, or thinking about, you know, Portuguese hegemony in the Indian Ocean. What those kind of statements do is they kind of wipe away all those micro encounters. They turn the whole thing into just this story that already has an end. Story that already has a conclusion,
right? And
if we do that, we lose the personality, we lose the individuality, we lose the small sets of meaningful encounters between individuals that really shape the world, so that you can go to Southern India and have this dish that it turns out is, you know, as Bram talked about, is based around, you know, Portuguese bread or this sort of thing. And to remember as well that, you know, that's a little Portuguese influence that came to Southern India. But well before that Portuguese influence, there was, you know, Southeast Asian influence going to India, and there was Indian influence going into Southeast Asia, and there's Chinese things moving around. And, you know, the whole world has always been formed through all those micro encounters as much, if not more so, than those macro encounters. And being attuned to that, being willing to kind of listen and see those stories is something that I think will make world history stronger, easier for students to connect to, and I think just also more interesting.
No, that's really well said. And I think what we love best often about world history, look, it's not like we don't ever want to talk about politics or you know, the governing of empires or anything, you know, because you know we're history junkies, so we can talk about a lot of different sort of facets and interfaces of history. But you know, when he talked about that dish, you know, in Southern India, you know, with the Portuguese sort of hybrid Portuguese, you know, name and the sense of, you know, flavor and aroma coming, you know, from the cook's oven, you know, and that kind of stuff, what you're calling that micro history, you know, is just as revealing, I think, of these global processes as if we were to read some formal sovereignty document coming out of Lisbon or, you know, the Mughal Empire or something. You know, not that those don't have their place, but we too often read them as fully encompassing, therefore, of the past historical experience. Whereas for most people, they didn't care about those things. You know, they didn't care about what the Mughal emperor said or what, you know, the Portuguese king, King Zhao said, you know, but they sure do know and are interested in this new bread, you know, that they can pair with their meal, right? You know, and how they can acquire it or you know, how they can assimilate it into their diets or something like that. You know, I remember Jerry Bentley, you know, the late world historian, one of the deans of the New World History, Jerry, you know, was talking about mozzarella de buffalo, you know, the what we'd regard as the very Italian mozzarella, you know, that goes on the pizza, and he's saying, look, this is coming from the water, the milk of the water buffalo, which is not native to Italy, right? But from Southeast Asia. And he was particularly attuned to those things, you know, as a historian. And I think a lot of what we often respond to and what Bram is doing, you know, is that kind of interface that people have in the past. It's not to deny cross-cultural influence, not to deny interconnection. It's just to deny that sort of rigid hegemonic model of governing, doing this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah. So hopefully you got a lot out of the interview. We would like to have Bram on again at some point, but for now we're going to let you go off to your lives. We were starting to get ready for the semester, as much as I hate to even say those words. And we will try to talk to you again real soon on History Against the Grain. Nobody is innocent. It's a sin when you play into ignorance. Another one goes in your eyes again. So you don't have to see what's happening. Then now, what's going on in these streets? You can't live by what you see on TV. Stuck in a cycle, so we rip.